Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Hello, everyone. I'm really happy to talk to you about this episode that I'm rerunning for you. It's my interview with Erin Borla, and she's with Roundhouse Foundation, and she focuses her funding strategies on supporting rural communities. And she talks about how important it is to really have special strategies that can address the priorities in these communities in ways that maybe urban communities, they might have different needs. And the reason I wanted to offer you this rerun, first of all, is that I'm working with Erin right now on a contract on a very interesting project. And so I was thinking about her because in partnership with her, I'm also now thinking carefully about how to fund in rural Oregon specifically. And I also think that, you know, I'm having a lot of fun picking out some of my favorite interviews so that we can really think through together, you and me, about how to be effective as a donor when you really want to move the needle on a major societal issue that you care about. In the case of Erin and Roundhouse Foundation, they want to be sure that philanthropy is leaning in to support these rural communities. Erin, this is such a pleasure. I have told you I wanted you on this podcast for so long, and I've threatened over and over. I'm like, we have to record some of our conversations because we have so many great ones. You have so many good insights about how to give well. And I would love you to talk to my listeners who also care very much about giving donations to nonprofits in an effective way. I want you to talk about your story. You're a trustee at the Roundhouse Foundation. It's, you know, your family started it, obviously. So I want to talk you to talk about that. And then let's just also talk about how you consider funding. How do you focus your funding strategies? How do you think of yourself as an effective funder? And oh, so many things to unpack. But let's start out with just your story. What made you passionate about giving, and why are you spending so much time on your family's foundation?
Well, thanks, Sybil. Thanks so much for having me and letting me join in on this wonderful thing that you're working on. Happy to have a conversation about all the wonderful things that we're doing here at Roundhouse. I think they're pretty great. So yeah, we are a private family foundation, Roundhouse Foundation. We are place-based, which means we are based in a small community called Sisters in Central Oregon. I always joke and say, you know, if Oregon was a big square, we'd be right on the east side of the Cascades, right in the middle. And the foundation was started years ago by my mother. My mom is Kathy Degendorfer. She's an artist by trade. My grandmother was Gerb Boyle, the CEO and a big leader of Columbia Sportswear. Was a real Oregon icon. My mom, as an artist here in Central Oregon, had been pulled onto all these different committees around economic development. In addition to the work that she did or has been doing as an artist, she had a small retail business, and she and my father did a bunch of other community economic development projects. So she kept getting pulled in onto these different committees to serve as sort of the creative voice. And okay, well, we have somebody that's in real estate and we have somebody that's in business, but she was the creative voice. Served on a variety of different boards, the Sisters Folk Festival, Sisters Outdoor Quilt Show. At one point, she was the chair of the Warm Springs Apparel Commission. And so she kept trying to solve some of these issues around what we were seeing around economic development in rural communities. Of oftentimes we're looking at the same issue in the same way. And if we bring creative people to the table, we're able to look at things slightly differently. And so how do we bring that additional voice? You know, a lot of our rural communities, particularly here in Oregon, were originally timber towns, and then they transitioned to tourism-related economies, none of which have been sustainable in the long term. And so now how do we bring in some additional economic resilience? And that was around creativity.
Yeah, and so you're really focusing in on rural conversations? How do you support rural Oregonians? And when we've talked, I mean, it sounds like a lot of the things you're working on are relevant for any person who cares about supporting their rural communities all across the country. So I think that what we talk about today is going to be relevant no matter where you live, not just in Oregon. Talk to me a little bit about how you at your foundation decided to focus in on supporting rural Oregonians, and then what are some of the key themes that you're leaning into?
And now for an ad, but don't go away because there's so much more to talk about. Hello, everyone. I want to let you know that I am putting forward a pretty exciting new podcast season, which is going to focus on the journey I took with one of my clients to think through effective funding strategies to reduce firearm-related suicide in rural and remote communities, specifically looking at Oregon as an example. So tune in to my podcast series September 30th through October 21st. Every Monday, I'll have a new special episode specifically discussing this issue. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so it's sort of a broader story, right? So with Kathy, my mom's engagement on the economic development side and the creative side, sort of the joke in the family was that my grandmother got tired of my mom saying, I need $500 for this cool project. So they started a very small foundation. We called it Roundhouse because we live in this very small community and didn't necessarily want it tied to our name. And just because we wanted to live in the community and not be seen as somebody different. And so focused on arts and culture, and recognized really quickly it was hard to be creative when your teeth hurt or you don't have access to healthy food or your kids don't have the opportunity to go to good schools. And so expanded our program areas to include environmental stewardship, education, and social services, all of which are really broad. And so essentially anything that any nonprofit is doing could fit into one of those four categories. We chose to really do that expansion work to all of rural Oregon after GERT passed in 2019. So we'd focused a lot of our efforts here in the Tri-County region. So Deschutes, Crook, Jefferson, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs for a long time, right here in Central Oregon. And then when GERT passed in 2019, we knew the foundation had been left as part of her estate plan. So we knew our organization was going to grow. With that, we had several meetings, I would say. I mean, we have a small trustee base, but we had several meetings where we got a chance to really just chat through, what does that look like when our organization grows? Can we continue to invest significantly more capital? And when I say grow, we grew over 1,000% in 18 months. So it wasn't like just a little bit, it was a lot. So if we were to consider investing significantly in just this small region, it could really saturate the region. And we didn't understand, we didn't know if that would be sustainable and what that looks like, because truly, especially grassroots organizations, we can blow them up from the inside out sometimes if we infuse too much capital up front and all those other things. So we made the decision, you know, GERT moved, was forced to immigrate to the United States in the 30s with her family because she was Jewish and was one of the first Jewish refugee families from the Holocaust to move to Portland. And Oregon treated her and her family very well. And it was important to us to reinvest into the communities that supported her and supported her family in that time of transition. And because the foundation had already been focused on a more rural region, even though many would say Deschutes County is not as rural anymore, we recognized how challenging it was to get capital to these smaller communities. So a lot of the foundations in the state of Oregon are based in along the I-5 corridor. So Portland, Salem, Eugene, it was hard to get money, whether it was private, corporate, state, federal, into other communities. So we made the intentional decision to focus in rural spaces. And with that, we talked about reservation communities and what does that look like? And so we called reservation communities out specifically. So now we say we support all of rural Oregon, the 9 federally recognized tribes and 54 historic bands of indigenous peoples. It was a journey to get there, but I'm really confident and happy how we did it.
Talk to me more about your grandma's immigration to Oregon and what are the specific things that people did that were welcoming for her?
Well, I wasn't alive then. So I don't know exactly.
What's the story? What's the family story?
So my grandmother, her two sisters, and her parents immigrated in 1937. My great-grandfather was a general in the First World War for the German army, and they were Jewish, and they also owned a shirt company in Germany, and that was back in the time when you shouldn't be Jewish, and it was a forced immigration. They made the choice to move their family here. We're sponsored by my great-uncle Max, who also lived in the region, and they came through Ellis Island. We were just in New York in April. We got to see her information in the book in Ellis Island, which was really
so cool. Yeah.
Then came through the Panama Canal, and we're here in Portland. And I know very little stories from her youth. I know she started the first grade at 13, which was how old she was when she immigrated. You could imagine, I have a 13-year-old now who would not be happy having to start in first grade at that age. She didn't speak a lick of English, except she could sing hot cross buns. So she quickly learned as much of the language as she could to get back up into her grade level. Graduated in 1941, I want to say. And then moved to Tucson, where she met my grandfather, famously under a table at a fraternity party. And
that's a story.
And then they moved back to Portland to take over what my grandfather had purchased was Columbia Hat Company, or my great grandfather. And so my grandpa Neil, my grandmother's husband at the time, or they were remained married. My grandmother was widowed, but he took over in 1945, had my uncle, then they had my mother. My Aunt Sally was born a few years after that. And my grandfather continued to run the company, which then my grandmother was a seamstress and a homemaker. She sewed the first fishing vest in her garage, and they ran this business. In 1970, my grandfather took out a loan, leveraging both their house and my great-grandmother's house against the expansion of the company. And then he died suddenly in December of 1970. And my grandmother went to work the next day because they employed several people and really tried to figure out how to manage what was going on. My uncle Tim dropped out of school and ended up coming to help. He was at the UO at the time. And it all sort of is history, right? The bank offered her what would have been $1,100 to buy her out. And she said, for that kind of money, I'll run it into the ground myself. And there she went. That.
And then, yeah. Now Columbia Sportswear is a very well-known company.
It is, yes. So we feel very fortunate to have had
And her. I love, and that story also, it just sort of helps me really think through, I mean, yeah, Oregon was good to you and the family because you were able to start this amazing business and your grandma had such a great role in it. I just love that story so much.
Yeah.
And, she
broke the glass ceiling in outdoor retail work as a woman. And she taught me a lot about what it means to be a woman in business, what it means to work with people that maybe think they know more than you, mm-hmm. and how to communicate. And that's, we all have different things that we can learn from each other. So.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And half of my family is Jewish. And so I have a lot of the similar stories. My dad, my granddad made Ackerman pants in the Bronx.
Oh, wow.
But he was not as successful.
No, that's very cool. I think, we all have this unique bit of history that helps build who we are and ties us to a familial legacy. And sometimes it's really fantastic. And sometimes it is more challenging. And we have to think through how those impact who we are as humans. And I think it's always fun to think through those things.
So. Yeah. And I love your connection there and to just your history and your family. And so now your foundation, let's go to now. Okay. So now your foundation has just gotten a lot larger very quickly. You're spending a ton of time as a family member, trustee, and running the foundation. And you've sort of generally focused on the issues you just outlined in rural Oregon.
Talk to me a little more about your process now. I mean, you hired a consultant, you did deliberately think through what are some of the key now substantive issues you're funding, and how did you come across, how did you decide on those? Because I think my listeners, I get this question all the time. How do we focus? How do we think through things, even though you have these broad interests?
And now for an ad, but don't go away because there's so much more to talk about. Hello, everyone. I'm so glad that you're enjoying my podcast. In my podcast, I hope to talk to you, the wonderful donors and philanthropists that I work with, to help you think through the most effective way to make your money matter. I also, in my podcast series and through all my trainings, want to help and support the nonprofits that are out there trying to raise money and hone their pitch. Because I'm somebody that works with donors, I get pitched all the time by amazing nonprofit leaders, so I know what it takes to raise money effectively. Please check out everything I have to offer at www.doyourgood.com. I have a whole host of course materials and lessons, videos, downloadable documents, a blog that I keep updated. All of it is 100% free for you to see and review and learn from. Please check it out. Again, www.doyourgood.com. Thanks a lot.
I'm watching you. I've watched you now. You're actually more focused than you give yourself credit for.
Well, the tough part, especially when you talk about rural, is the intersectionality of work, right? So philanthropy and philanthropists are really good at saying, I am only a arts funder. I am only a climate funder. I am only a, you know, the childcare funder. And the intersectionality of all of the things, especially in smaller communities, is so critical. You can't have one without the other. We can't have climate smart work happening in rural space if we're not talking to agriculture. If we're not talking to agriculture, then we're talking about, you know, we have to talk about economy. We have to talk about, well, what does that look like for the education program and the schools and that? So they all interconnect. So there is a process. So I stepped in as a trustee in 2014, but then I stepped in as a staff person in January of 2020, which was a unique opportunity to step in, knowing that our organization was growing. You're right. We did end up hiring a consultant. I'm very much in the sort of like structure. I'm into the structure of an organization. I want to make sure that it's sustainable. I want to know how things work. I want to make sure that we know how decisions are made so that we can be super transparent to people when they ask. So we built some of those bigger structures. We had meetings with our trustee base. We had meetings, brought in a consultant. We did some one-on-one interviews, things like that, and really sat and worked through our current mission and our vision, made a few tweaks and a few changes, but kept our same four program focus areas for the first year. As we started receiving disbursements from the estate, we also made the decision to pivot our entire endowment to 100% mission aligned. So we did a big investment transition at the same time as we were building and growing. So there was a lot of moving parts when we were growing. But the endowment did not come in all at once. The estate did not disperse all at once. So throughout that first year, I came in super excited in January of 2020. Okay, we have all these plans. This is what this is going to look like. And then in March, COVID hit. And then it was like, oh, well, that is going to throw a wrench in the system. Okay, what does that look like? Well, now we have, you know, we're consistently tracking the 5% that is the required distribution from the federal government. Okay, well, as this disbursement is coming in from the estate, the 5% is increasing like this. And anybody that's done this work before knows that it's a rolling average of averages that can be exhaustive if you don't spend every day looking at numbers. So it became my second hobby to sort of like watch those numbers, but then also try and figure out, okay, how much are we going to have to distribute this year in comparison to last year? And what does that look like? And what's that intentional growth pattern? And how are we going to show up in community so it doesn't just look like, surprise, we're here. Here's a bazillion dollars. So we were really thoughtful in that process. We chose two big projects that were, one was our very large initial investment that we've never done of that size before, which was a capital investment to the High Desert Museum of $6 million. And that was a disbursement over a period of 5 years. But it really felt like it was a clearly aligned project, centering the values of rural communities and rural space and highlighting how this region has come, what we've come from with their work with Indigenous people and continued work with Indigenous peoples, all of the, to the westward settlement, to the wildlife, to the logging industry and the forest industry. So it told all these stories and wove all these pieces together that felt like a really great sort of launch. So we spent that first year, we actually didn't launch until 2021 with that grant, but we spent that first year sort of deciding what that would look like. During the COVID crisis, which we're still, I guess, sort of in, I'm unclear, we tried to find other funders. That was the first thing that I did, was I reached out to other Oregon funders and I said, hi, we've been around for a while. We'd like to fund things too, but now we're expanding. What else are you funding? Can we share lists? Can we coordinate? How do we talk to you? But during COVID, things sort of shut down and shifted. And so we were just trying to track and build relationships. And then George Floyd was murdered. And so then it became, okay, how do we also talk about racial reckoning? But how do we talk about what race looks like in rural space? And how do we talk about equity when the reality is these communities are also really distant from where decisions are made? And yes, there is diversity in rural space, but if we just box check to make sure a board looks a certain way, we're not truly building leadership capacity within those communities. So how do we work alongside community to ensure that they are doing their very best with what they can, rather than just trying to get a check, right? So it just kept coming and coming and coming of all these things. Everybody that lived through 2020 knows these things. So, and then in Oregon.
Yeah, well, it was kind of, Aaron, though, I mean, everyone does know, but the thing that's really interesting about your perspective is right at the same time, you were coming into an enormous amount of potential wealth where you, not even potential, actual wealth, where you really had the ability to put it back into community. And there was, it was such a poignant, intense time. I mean, this is really interesting, Aaron. Actually, we haven't talked about this in as much depth before. This is one of the reasons I love podcasts, is because I learn new things about my friends. Anyway, I just wanted to underline that because it's important.
Yeah. And I think it's important that, you know, I think people hear the term wealth and they think of individual wealth. And I think the funding came into the foundation. So it is owned 100% by the foundation. It is a family foundation. So there is this sort of thought process. It's hard for people to disconnect the family with the funding, which is why we chose to name the foundation Roundhouse and not, you know, Kathy Deggendorfer Foundation. But I think there's a difference there. There's a distinct, we are a steward of these dollars. These are not our dollars.
Oh, another great point. Right.
And I think it's hard for me to kind of talk through that piece, but it's such an incredible privilege and honor to be a steward and to honor the legacy that helped bring those dollars to fruition, but also to say we have this power to do some really incredible things in community. And you and I've had this conversation where it's like, our job as philanthropists, I think, is easy. And I will die on that mountain, that we get to sit behind a desk and fill out a check. The people truly doing the work are those in community. And how do we continue to elevate their story with our job? So if that's what makes our job hard, is like pushing the elevation.
And not getting in the way of our own selves here.
Oh, we're so good at that.
Yeah, we can be. I know. Darn it.
That's right.
So I keep trying to get you to this place because I know you're here, but you keep pushing back on me a little bit.
There's more to the story.
We'll do more to the story too. But I would love you to tell my listeners, there are specific areas of work that you are focused in on and you're excited about. So just give my listeners a little bit of an understanding of where you've landed on that. Given the intersectionality and everything else, there's some really interesting work you're doing.
So, and there's a reason that I keep backtracking, is because it took us all of those experiences to determine those. It wasn't like, I woke up and went, I'm going to fund, you know, knitting. So 2020 happens. We have COVID. We have George Floyd's murder and a racial reckoning. We're managing rural communities, sort of managing through that process. and then the wildfires, and that were devastating across Oregon. And as a even though we'd been around for a while as a relatively new, bigger funder in the state, I didn't have those relationships with other funders. And people were very generous with their time, but it required a lot of like, hi, hey, would you Zoom with me? I have money as well. I'd like to deploy this capital. How can I get money alongside what you're... So there were a lot of phone calls in the back end. And that built some relationships, but I still saw some struggles of like where I saw funding going and where I saw it being missed, which a lot of that was in our rural and frontier spaces. It then led to us getting in the car, right? As COVID sort of went through these waves and some of the down points, we got in the car and drove all over the state. We spent weeks at a time. I mean, I think I put 30,000 miles a year on my pickup all over and met with people and said, tell us what you're doing. Tell us what's happening. How is this impacting your community? Our first big visit was in Northeastern Oregon. And I had a nonprofit say, you're the first funder that's been here in 3 years. And that made such a profound impact on me and our trustees that traveled with me that it was like, what do you mean we're not? Oh, I'd travel to Portland once a quarter and give a presentation. What are we doing? We're actually having to pay more because we're paying for them to travel to us. It's so counterintuitive. The more that we got in community, the more we learned. And I always say the same thing. Rural is not a monolith. Not every rural community is the same. If you come up with one thing that you think is going to fix rural, you're wrong. There are things that each community is different and unique. We all like to think we're special. It's true. But there are these through lines, which I'm getting to your point that you want me to get to.
No, but I love the journey. No, I love all of it. All of it. The journey is also part of it. And that's really important. Yep. So thanks for doing that, Erin. Okay. So now we're getting to the key points there.
There are these through lines that came through, and it's like we kept hearing, okay, typically as a smaller funder, and smaller being grants of anywhere from $500 to $5,000, $10,000, it was, okay, how do we fix this need right now? What does the need look like right now? It's, you know, I always use the example, the freezer goes out in the food bank. We got to fix it. But now we have the ability to scale and strategize a little bit. So we can fix the freezer. We can come up with something that's going to fix the freezer. But then let's talk about what does that look like in 12 to 18 months? How do we fill that freezer? And then let's look at these big, longer strategies. Why do we need the freezer in the first place? Why does the food bank exist? What's that root cause? So I use that example a lot because people can really understand it. So as we look at those through lines that came through, we were looking at like, okay, on some of these bigger issues, what can we move the needle on that will truly make an impact across community? So here we go. Get ready. Community food systems is one. So these, we kept the same four program focus areas. Now we have what we call 7 strategic initiatives that fall within those 4 focus areas. Community food systems, community resilience and disaster response and relief, early childhood education and childcare, career technical education and workforce development, rural healthcare access, particularly access to pharmaceuticals, gun violence prevention, particularly firearm-related suicide. We call it youth, arts, culture, and healing. And so as we talk about mental health with young people, it's how do we get particularly students of color or young people of color reconnected to their culture for mental health support. So whether that is working with Indigenous communities and language revitalization or access to outdoor spaces for forest work or gathering, whether it's Latinx communities, working with leadership development that's culturally specific, those types of projects. So that's our other bucket.
It's so great because I want my listeners to really think about this. You heard Erin's story, and then she was able, even though there's all these different pieces and she's focused on intersectionality, she was able to also think about through lines that are really important. And then what you also did, Erin, is in the beginning, when I watched you, it was really you and a consultant or two that were helping you think through strategy. Now you've hired staff and you're able to hire staff because you have those particular areas of expertise you need. And then you're recruiting these amazing people who are then also going out in the field and helping you. How does that evolution worked for you? Because that's a real transition as well to have staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had like a finance person for quite a while. So in addition to our grant making, we also operate a 260-acre working ranch that serves as an artist residency and living laboratory for the foundation. So we've had staff that sort of help manage that for a while.
Yeah, although to push back a little bit, that's kind of that staff that focuses on the ranch, the program officer, the art of making grants, it's a very different kind of thing. Yeah.
It is, correct. So our first, we have one person that's been with us through the whole journey. She's lovely. She's our finance person. Our first real big hire outside of the facility was our grants manager, a data manager, just to help us track what does that application look like? What's the process look like? How do we use that process? And I was naive and I was like, we're going to hire this grants manager and they're also going to be an office manager. They're going to be the ones that answer the phone and give tours and do all this stuff. And then people found out that we had money to distribute and the phone kept ringing and the applications kept coming in. And well, that job became a lot more than we anticipated. So, but she's fantastic and I would do anything in the world to keep her. So if you find a good data person, they are wonderful, keep them. They're awesome because they can make or break and change your life. So we hired her and also continued to hire folks that kind of work on the facility and on our arts program that we have here at the ranch. What Sybil's talking about specifically, or what you're talking about when you talk about you in the third person, is our latest round of hires, which was our grant program directors. And we initially set out to hire a lead in two of one of the seven projects that we talked about. We had great response to that process, and we're thrilled to be able to have a lovely pool of applicants. We ended up only hiring one who is awesome and works on our rural healthcare project and is really dedicated to being out in community. That was a big piece of the work that we wanted to ensure because I was in the community. I travel 25% of my time. So that was an important piece. They had to be able to connect in community. We ask about lived rural experience. You know, I can teach you about philanthropy. It's harder for me to teach you how to communicate with people that have a different lived experience or lifestyle. So we hired one grant program director around healthcare and then ended up hiring a grant program specialist who serves in our office as sort of a generalist. So as inquiries and requests come in, they can filter and be the balance. They've proved to have some interest in the childcare work. So our healthcare person we hired out of a healthcare program had done a little bit of work in philanthropy, but very small through health council. And then our grant program specialist we hired out of social services and had been working for a nonprofit for 16 years. They have just been lovely people to work with. They understand community. They understand the challenges that nonprofits go through because they lived it.
Yeah. And you did your hiring after you went through the process of figuring out your issue areas. So I can imagine that that would be helpful for you. But I'm just thinking back on how much you were carrying yourself before you got here. Hats off. I mean, also with all the things that in addition to COVID with the wildfires and just the list goes on. While you were navigating this. So you're also about to launch a podcast series yourself to discuss rural work and how to think through it. I'd love you to talk to my audience about what you're doing there.
Yeah, for sure. So I mentioned reaching out to statewide funders when we first started. I also have very little shame when it comes to recognizing, like, I am not the first person that's ever done this work before. And there are other philanthropists and other folks that have been through this experience, that have led family foundations, that are dealing with trustees that might be their parents or, you know, have gone through what in the foundation world, you call it a wealth event, which is real gross, but so a big expansion. So I reached out to a variety of philanthropy serving organizations and I said, I'm going to be your needy best friend and you're going to introduce me to all the people that you know that have done this work, whether they're in Oregon or Washington or Rhode Island, I don't care. I want to know, I want to talk to people that have done this before. And through that, we joined a variety of different PSOs and learned a lot.
And PSO stands for Philanthropy Support Organizations.
Yes.
So, whenever I use that word, people are like, PSO?
Is
that?
Yeah, it's like a chamber of commerce for philanthropy. That's the way I describe it. And every time I would call these folks, whether it was an issue related topic, right? There's philanthropy serving organizations that focus on climate or focus on healthcare. And then there's some more general. So every time I would call any of those, and I think we're a member of like 6 or 8 now at this point, I get the same 6 questions. We're the only rural place-based funder that we work with. You're the only person that does this work. Why is rural important? What do you mean there's diversity in rural? So after the third time, I kind of like had to channel my inner being and go, okay, why is no one else talking about this on a national scale? It still is surprising. If you were to ask
me. And just to make sure, Erin, everyone gets it. Why isn't everyone talking about this? Define what the this is. Why isn't everybody talking about this? What is it exactly that you feel is the gap?
I am incredibly naive thinking that people recognize that there are challenges that rural communities face that are different than urban and metro communities. That is this.
Well said. Well said.
So it was the biggest surprise for me across the whole thing, all of the things. And I have done a lot of the things, as you mentioned, was to have conversations around with very smart people who are willing to invest significant amounts of capital that they have raised or stewarded to make some changes on these issue topics. And they're not talking to half the population. And it was so confusing to me. And so having to answer those 6 questions over and over and over, and then which it's fine. I don't mind answering. I'm like, I'll talk barriers all day about how people don't have access to some of these things. So one of those organizations is an organization called the National Center for Family Philanthropy, NCFP. They're based out of Washington, D.C. They do a lot of work supporting family philanthropists. And I got a phone call that we're a member, and they said, hey, you should consider running or applying for this fellowship that we have. And I said, I don't have a tremendous amount of time. What does that mean? And they said, no, I think it would be good. I think it'd be good to talk about the rural work that you're doing and the Indigenous work. I mean, I am not an Indigenous person. We serve as an ally in this space to try and elevate and activate additional dollars to Indigenous communities. I think you should apply. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I applied. I was so lucky and honored to be the recipient of a fellowship, which is a 2-year process. And then they said, what's your project? And I went, oh, I don't know. What do you want my project to be? So I set out trying to build this concept of like, well, I've answered these same 6 questions 150 times. I might as well write it down. What's the answer?
Yeah, for the record, you were being sarcastic about, I don't know. It's people can't.
No, I really didn't know. I didn't know what
really?
My, I mean,
didn't?
No, I was
okay.
Like,
okay.
I didn't know. I actually didn't know. Okay. Oh, to do a project. Okay. I am very sarcastic. So there's parts of that, but I really didn't know.
Okay. You really
didn't.
So
it did come up with like, okay, I'm going to write these blog posts about, and then I said, you know, a lot of our work is how we elevate the people on the ground. I spent a ton of time just now talking about how my job is not that hard. The people on the ground are having the hard job. I want to tell their story, not my story. So I want them to say how rural is important and why it should be valued. And so I said, well, maybe I'll do this podcast instead. And we had funded a podcast a couple of times talking, one about women ranchers working in climate change, a woman named Ashley Ahern, who is a podcaster, used to work for NPR. So we funded that project. And then we funded another project recently around Mustangs, wild Mustangs that she had done. So I called her and I said, I have this harebrained idea. I want to do this podcast. What do you think? And she's like, I love it. I'll produce it. So here we are. So it originally was going to be this series of conversations around those same 6 questions. And then I just couldn't get traction on it. I ended up doing 2 interviews with people that I value and treasure their opinions very much on work that they're doing in rural spaces and why that's important. And I heard those 2 sort of rough cuts put together and it all fell into place. So it's a 16 episode arc. Most likely will launch in early spring of 2024. Altogether, all 16 will publish at the same time. It's called Funding Rural, and it is really talking about, our hope is in the very beginning. The first few episodes are talking with folks that work on a national scale about, with philanthropy and with federal and state agencies that fund in rural communities, about some of those challenges, some things that are some myths that we've heard, other things like that, sort of a baseline about funding in rural spaces. It'll then transition into some of that authentic storytelling, how we get news and information from rural spaces, how that can sometimes be interpreted differently depending on who's writing the story or who's producing that story. And then talking more about some of the, really a lot about the scale of landscape, the distance. When we talk about climate, we are not talking about the city park. We're talking about miles, you know, what that looks like in comparison with private lands and public lands, and how, if we want to have climate conversations, we have to include private landowners. And that means including agriculture and fishers and things like that. And then really transitioning at the end of the series with some of the alignment that, as we talk about equity, where we're seeing alignment between underserved and underrepresented communities, whether they're communities of color or others, and rural communities, and really seeing things that are very similar, but our foundation partners are not maybe necessarily seeing them in the same way. So that's sort of the plan.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it. It's going to be so interesting. And you're interviewing. I mean, first of all, you have this amazing person who's going to be really experienced in doing the storytelling. And I can't wait to hear the stories. I can't wait. Are you going to have any previews for us? You know, I'll air this. For my listeners, I'm going to air this interview in December. And then, because I always batch my stuff, so we're talking a little ahead of December, but it's going to be in December, but then it's going to come out in the spring. So I'll be sure to remind all my listeners when it comes out. But if you have teasers ahead of time, I definitely want to have links to things so people can hear maybe some sample stories, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I would love that. I think that's all a piece of what we're trying to pull together. The hope is to sort of launch everything at once, but having some of that data available ahead of time, as far as the things that we'll be talking about and topics that may be of interest to folks. You're so good at this. You've done this a long time. You've probably done a bazillion of these podcast interviews. I feel like 100% an amateur, but I just love having conversations with folks. And I think we can get through a lot of things that can pull out some actions just by having conversation. You know, I had one of the initial interviews was with the state director for USDA here in the state of Oregon. And we talk a lot about how do we leverage federal capacity and federal capital into these communities that maybe struggle with technical assistance, with capacity, with the ability. And she talks a lot about finding those unicorn projects that have the community member that's willing to put in the time and do all these things. And so how do we deconstruct the unicorn to be able to replicate it? And I love that concept so much. So that's a teaser for you. How about that?
That's perfect. Yeah. How do we deconstruct the unicorn? There you go. Wonderful, Erin. This has been so much fun. I don't want to stop talking, but I guess we have to, because, you know, it's been a while that we've been talking. And I can't wait till the next time that I come by your ranch and we can talk more about these important issues. I just really value that you're putting such an emphasis on rural Oregon and just rural communities, and making sure that funders recognize and understand the unique stories and conversation we need to have to think through how to show up right in those communities. So thanks, Erin.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.